This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel, and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
And we are live. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Non Sequitur. It seems like we have been meeting rather too frequently here lately. What a week it has been. Crazy week, but a good week. Steve, did you like last night's discussion?
That was one of the greatest things I've ever had to listen to. I enjoyed that thoroughly. I mean, people were even saying, God, Kyle and Steve are quiet this entire thing, because we were just enjoying it. We were just like enthralled by the conversation that was going on. So, yeah.
It's a little more noticeable when you're quiet, though.
This is true, because I can't shut up. I don't talk that much. I really don't.
Yeah, you do. You really do. But anyway, welcome back to Non Sequitur. I'm Kyle Curtis. He's Steve McRae. Dave is producing. And all the way from down under, where it is, it's daylight here. So that must mean, according to a flat earth, that it is daylight also where you are. Oh.
It is, actually.
It didn't work, did it? Maybe they're right then. Maybe they're right.
Maybe. Well, welcome. Yeah, we just proved them right.
Welcome, Tim O'Neill. Tim runs the blog historyforatheist.com, as you see on your screen. How are you doing, sir? Thank you for coming on Non Sequitur.
Mate, I'm very well. It's 10 in the morning down here, and it is daylight. I don't know what that proves, but I'm fine. Great to be on the show. Thanks.
Illuminati conspiracy is what it proves.
Exactly. we were talking prior to the show. Me and Steve can't figure out why smart people actually still come chat with us. We're happy that they do, but very puzzled nonetheless. But we are glad that that Tim is joining us here, and we're going to get into it a little bit more with Tim here in just a second. Let's, as always, look ahead at what we have. I feel like a meteorologist sometimes. Let's look ahead for what we've got coming up tomorrow. As you'll see in the forecast, debate roulette will be raining down, hopefully to put out that dumpster fire I'm expecting, but maybe not. If you would like to participate in debate roulette, what that is we have a wheel of topics. They're random. Some of them serious, some of them not so serious. We're going to try to mix those up really well tomorrow, but we'll spin the wheel. A topic will be chosen, and then you guys will vote. And a person will be selected from the people who voted in the affirmative, and a person will be selected from a person who voted in the negative. And those two people will come in on the show. We will give you the structure of the debate, which is three 5-minute rounds, followed by a 10-minute block of just back and forth open discussion. And that will be it. We're going to try to fit in three rounds. This time we got two in on the previous two, and the previous two went really well. So if you're interested in participating, go to our Discord. Link is in the description. And there is a channel called Debate Roulette. That's where you will be stationed off and voting. Okay, and then on Sunday, back again, Aaron Ra will be joining us to this time take on a old Earth creationist, George Lujak. Emailed me and said that he didn't think Kent Hovind defended the faith as well as he could have. So he's going to come in and try to pick up where Kent left off. And that will be at 8 o'clock on Sunday. Both shows, actually, I forgot to say this, Debate Roulette and the Aaron Rodd debate will be at 8 Eastern. So join us for that. And then tomorrow we'll get into what we've got coming up next week. Okay, so Tim O'Neill, you are both beloved and kind of somewhat controversial in our communities. Do you want to kind of introduce yourself and explain why some people may not like what you have to say?
Yeah, okay. I've been an atheist all my adult life, which now means over 30 years. And I've also been fascinated by history, particularly ancient and medieval history. And it's interesting that these two things have kind of come together in the last few years. The reason I'm disliked by some is that I write a blog that effectively debunks a lot of ideas that some of our fellow atheists hold very, very dear. And my problem is that, unfortunately, some of the arguments that many, not all, but many atheists use, which are particularly against Christianity, which are based on history, are based on historical ideas which historians reject, which are outdated, or which are based on fringe theories which don't have a great deal of academic credibility or respectability. And I suppose after a few years of taking part online in various forums and blogs and listening to podcasts by atheists and hearing these historical errors being used as a basis for arguments against religion, I got a bit frustrated. I also got a little bit tired of repeating myself when responding to this stuff online, so I thought I'll write a blog, write some fairly detailed and quite lengthy articles on why historians don't accept these ideas. And then I don't have to repeat myself. I can sort of link to the blog. That was the idea. It was meant to save me time. That hasn't really worked because the topics just keep on coming and I have to keep on writing articles. But the reaction has been interesting because a great many people respond to me and say, this is great, thanks very much. I thought that Christians did burn down the Great Library of Alexandria and now I know that's a myth. Others are less open to the idea that perhaps they might be wrong. As we were just discussing, some atheists can be as dogmatic as certain Christians. And the other funny thing is that, and this sort of bothers me a little bit, but sometimes my stuff is being used by Christian apologists, and I can't help that. But if atheists are saying stuff that is historically not respectable or just plain wrong, and Christians are picking it up, then I think that's more of a reason why we should stop using stupid arguments. I mean, if someone who believes that Noah's Ark actually happened and that the universe is 6,000 years old are laughing at us for getting stuff wrong, then perhaps we should stop getting stuff wrong.
That's a good point.
Because, I mean, atheists are not excluded from not saying stupid shit, just like anybody else, right? I mean, we've seen people have bad arguments across the board. And when they're called out on it, can they address those rebuttals? And can they actually give a reason why they think those arguments that they're using are any good? Because I've seen just as many people use bad arguments, no matter if they're a theist or an atheist.
The thing that I find funny, though, is why wouldn't anybody, like, take what you say as, you know, in a constructive way? Like, why do you want to be wrong? You know, the facts are the facts. So if you're saying something that's wrong, why do you want to continue saying what's wrong? I mean, I know it hurts sometimes to admit that we make mistakes and that we're infallible, but if you really are trying to put forth the truth and trying to refute a bad claim made by Christians, it seems to me that you would want to be right and would welcome your type of expertise on that.
Yeah, Carl, I think that's very true. When we're talking about stuff that's just a plain matter of fact, then it is kind of inexplicable that some people do continue to argue stuff that's wrong. One of the difficulties here, though, is we're talking about history. And history is a matter of interpretation. It's not like the hard sciences where you can prove things one way or another. It is a matter of taking the evidence that we have and coming up with what we think might most likely have happened, which means that people can argue against the kinds of oppositions that I'm taking. It's just that usually the arguments that they're using and some of the stuff that they're drawing on is not regarded very highly by current historians. So what I try and do is I try and avoid topics that are in any way controversial among scholars. I try and stick to consensus positions because there certainly are some areas where we simply have to say we just don't know. So I try to stick to the areas where there is a good solid scholarly consensus. And one of the things that the people who don't like me often say is, well, he's not actually a professional historian. I'm not. You know, I'm a reasonably, I would hope, reasonably well-read amateur. But what I always do is I always draw on the scholarship of actual historians, and I always make sure that I'm working from, as I said, consensus positions. If I ever refer to an argument or a position that isn't a consensus position, I always try and indicate. And a couple of times I've said, well, I think this is actually a convincing idea about this, but it's not a widely held view. It's these guys think this way, and I think I happen to agree. But on the whole, I'm always referring to the work of scholars. So when people say you don't have a PhD in history, I say no, but like all the guys that, you know, you can see the bookshelf behind me, they all do. So you're not arguing with me. Right. You're arguing with them.
Yeah. Yeah. I told Tim at the start of this that this will probably be a several part episode with Tim. I mean, if by the end he feels that he wants to come back, we always wonder, like I said at the beginning. But if he feels like he had a good time, then he wants to come back. There's so much that you do, and so many topics that you cover, and the topics that you cover have so many layers to them that it would just be crazy to think we could, you know, pack that all in into an hour and a half. But nonetheless, yeah. I think they're important because, especially for what, you know, kind of what we do with having debates and discussions, we hear a lot of these things all the time. Like some of the things that you talk about are just regular occurrences in several different people's arguments. So tell me what, let me finish why I said that. I want this to kind of be like an overall introduction to the things that you cover and kind of hit each one very lightly and explain why, you know, either they're incorrect or they're misconstrued. And I figure we'll start with what you think personally, what's the most misconstrued argument that atheists use in their arguments that really just gets to you on a personal level?
I'm pretty rational, so I try not to get sort of emotional about it, even if I do sometimes come across as being a bit acerbic in my blog.
You're frequently asked questions. If you haven't read it, guys, go to historyforatheists.com and read his frequently asked questions. It's the best done section. Frequently asked question page on the internet, because there's a question that says something to the effect of like, why are you such an asshole about it? And you're like, because it's my blog and I'll say whatever I want to about whatever issue that I want to. And I was like, finally, somebody says it, you know, like somebody doesn't gloss over the fact that they can say whatever they want to. And if people don't like it, they can just click the little X box in their corner. Yeah. So it was refreshing.
Yeah,
well done.
Thanks, man. Someone just yesterday sort of saying, well, you know, I don't like your stuff and you're too sort of sarcastic and stuff. And I said, okay, then fuck off.
Right.
No one's forcing you to read my blog. So, you know, feel free to fuck off. I said to this guy, I cannot express how much I do not fucking care what you think. Fuck off. And people go, well, you're being rude. I said, I'm not.
You might be my favorite guest.
I am. But, you know, I'm being frank. Yeah. But back to your question. If there's one argument about history that I hear all the time from atheists that really pisses me off, it's this idea that it's what I call the meta myth of New Atheist Bad History. It's the idea that once upon a time there were the Greeks and Romans, and they were incredibly rational and wise and scientific, and they were on the brink of bringing about a full industrial revolution, and we're all about to go and live on colonies on the moons of Jupiter or something. And then Christianity came along and destroyed ancient civilization, destroyed ancient culture and learning, plunged us into a 1,000-year dark age where scientists were burned at the stake and the church controlled everything. And it wasn't until the glorious dawning of the wonderful Renaissance, where suddenly people started being smart again, that we managed to get back on track, and we had a scientific revolution, an industrial revolution. But Christianity held us back, and we should all be living in glass cities under the sea, playing with sea monkeys or some shit.
You are a Christian.
No, I don't.
Must be, yeah.
I agree with you. I'm being facetious.
I'm being facetious. I agree too.
Obviously, that was a caricature of the argument, but there is this this pervasive idea that there was this period when Christianity controlled the world, and in that period there was no science and there was no technological advancement. And it's just fucking bullshit. It just isn't true. But I come across it all the time. And when you try and sort of push back against it, people say, well, are you denying that there was a dark age? And I say, no, I'm not. I'm saying that it had nothing to do with Christianity. It had everything to do with the collapse of the Western Roman Empire. If your civilization collapses, you tend to have a few other things on your mind other than doing a whole lot of science. So that's what happened. And when the knowledge started to come back into Western Europe, it wasn't during the Renaissance, the one with the pretty pictures and the crackpot inventor. It was during the 12th century, in the middle of the high Middle Ages, and it was thanks to, and this is the bit that a lot of atheists don't like, it was thanks to Christians. It was thanks to Christian clergy who loved this learning that had been lost and went looking for it and found it in Arabic translation in Sicily and Spain. So if there's a general sort of idea that I'm constantly sort of fighting against and arguing against, it's sort of that meta myth, because a lot of people just love that whole narrative, even though it's basically a lot of bullshit. I call it the cartoon version of history.
Yeah, to me, I equate somebody that wants to make that argument to Christians wanting to say that, you know, all atheists are Satan worshipers. You know, you caricature a group based on stereotypes that you know, and you want to blame them for everything bad that happens. Now, yes, as a whole, I think Christianity is a bad thing, but that doesn't mean that it didn't have good things in it as well, you know, good parts, and you can't blame it for everything. I just don't know why that's controversial. Like, I don't know, understand why that's something that you get flack for.
Don't know. I mean, people like to cling to the myths, but within that sort of meta myth, there are stories that people usually sort of come back at me at and say, well, what about the murder of Hypatia of Alexandria because she was a scholar? What about the burning of the Great Library of Alexandria because they hated knowledge? What about all the scientists who were burnt at the stake? And I usually say, name one, and they usually can't. So people come back and they love these stories, and I call them the atheist fairy tales. And people are encouraging me to write a book based on the stuff in my blog. And I'm thinking of actually starting each chapter with once upon a time and telling an atheist fairy tale at the beginning, and then in the chapter sort of going through why the real history is actually quite different. And the other thing that I suppose that annoys me a bit about this stuff. Oh, thanks. The other thing that does sort of annoy me about this stuff is that the real history is much more interesting than the caricature. The caricature is usually much more stupid and boring, but when you get into the real stuff, it's actually quite fascinating. And sure, there's no doubt at all that Christianity has done and continues to do horrible things. There's no doubt that they did burn people at the stake. They just didn't burn anyone at the stake. Because of science. That's a myth. They were too busy burning people to stake because of fucking religion, which is bad enough. Not as though I'm saying Christianity is great and they've always done wonderful things. I had someone yesterday saying to me, well, you know, Christianity did all these terrible things. Why do you defend Christianity? What about what they did to the Native Americans? And I said, show me where I've ever said the Christianity didn't do horrible things to the Native Americans. Right? Just because some stuff that we say about Christianity is true doesn't mean everything that we say people say about Christianity that Christianity has done is bad. Is therefore automatically true. That doesn't make sense.
And I don't think that you can be blamed for defending Christianity. I think that what you're doing is defending history, you know, like a historical aspect of it. Yeah. It sounds disingenuous to say that you're defending Christianity because you're not. You're just saying what actually happened. And for people to, you know, want to remain clueless, like I said, I don't get. But this is why I said that we need to. This is going to be kind of like an introduction to those points, because when you say that the actual story is fascinating more so than the caricature, that's the truth. And you could probably do an entire episode on each point that you make. But obviously, when I'm looking at your blog and I'm looking at the different topics that you cover, one thing popped out in my mind instantly, because we cover it here all the time. And I think that it should be the one that we start with, because I'm interested to hear more about it. And that is the medieval view of flat Earth.
Yeah. Oh, this is a great one. Let's start with the fairy tale. Once upon a time, the Greeks discovered that and worked out scientifically that the Earth was round. But then along came Christianity and suppressed that knowledge because, you know, they were a pack of assholes. And then everyone was taught by the Catholic Church that the Earth was flat because they believed the Bible said so, and they only believed that the Bible could be interpreted literally. And it wasn't until Christopher Columbus came along and defied the church and told them they were wrong and proved that they were wrong by sailing to America that we discovered once again that the Earth was round. And so the church was wrong and the Greeks and science and Columbus and Americans are good. And this is a great little fairy tale, and it's also a founding myth of the United States, because Columbus is the hero of this story. The problem with it, though, despite the fact it's a great story, is that it's complete bullshit, and it's simply not true. So, yes, the Greeks did indeed work out that the Earth was round, and that was something that quite a few other people, including, say, the ancient Israelites or the Chinese, hadn't worked out. The Chinese didn't work out that the Earth was round until we went over to China in the 15th and 16th century and told them. But the Greeks certainly did work it out, and they worked it out roughly how big it was. You know, Eratosthenes famously used some quite fundamental geometry to come up with a very accurate estimate of the size of the Earth. The bit that's a myth is the idea that Christianity suppressed this. So where did the myth come from? It actually was invented by Washington Irving, who was the American novelist who wrote The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, and was commissioned by his editors in the 1820s to write a biography of Christopher Columbus. Now, the problem with writing a biography of Christopher Columbus is the story of Christopher Columbus isn't actually very interesting. He thought he was sailing to India, and he crashed into America at the end. So he had to come.
Great story.
That's right. He had to spice it up a bit. Now, anyone who writes, it was a fictionalized biography. So anyone who writes fiction knows that the essence of all fiction is conflict. So what he did was he invented a conflict. He invented a dispute in 15th century Spain about the shape of the earth, made Columbus the guy who was saying that it was round, and then had him win the debate by sailing across the Pacific to America. This was all made up. Washington Irving made the whole thing up because he needed to make his novel a bit more interesting. The book went on to become a bestseller, particularly in the United States, for obvious reasons. So then it became this story became embedded in what people in the US thought they knew about history. And so it became a common idea that people in the Middle Ages thought that the Earth was were taught that the Earth was flat. The truth of it is, people in early Christian, like the first two or three centuries of Christianity, did look at the Bible and say, "Well, there are bits in the Bible that say that the Earth is flat." And there were a couple of guys, a guy called Lactantius and another guy called Cosmas, who took that and said, "Well, the Bible says so, therefore it must be true." Most Christian thinkers, though, were also educated enough in Greek natural philosophy to know that the evidence that the earth was round was pretty clear. So they said, these bits in the Bible are figurative. And the idea that all early Christianity was based on a literal translation, literal interpretation of the Bible is not true. In fact, the idea that the Bible should be taken literally is a very modern idea that was invented. Again, we can blame you guys in the United States in the 19th
century. By Kent Hovind, we know. It was invented by Kent Hovind, we know.
So it's a very recent idea. Most ancient medieval Christians, certainly the Catholic Church to this day, the Eastern Orthodox churches to this day, believe that you can interpret parts of the Bible literally, but there are other parts which are purely figurative. So they didn't actually have a problem with the idea of the earth being round. And as a result, throughout the whole of the Middle Ages, it was taught that the earth was round. When Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century was writing his massive Summa Theologica, his enormous opus on theology, and he wanted to use an example of an objective scientific fact that everyone could agree to, guess which example he used? He used the idea that the earth was round. So it was extremely well known. It was extremely well known amongst scholars. He sure as hell would.
what changed? Why do people think that now then? It's such an objective fact, which I do agree. What do you think changed to nowadays, why people want to promote this?
Well, people have suddenly become flat earthers again. I think there is always a percentage of human beings who are fucking idiots.
This is true. And
that's
happened.
Right. And that's been the case.
You sound like you were getting ready to give a profound. Was expected. That was awesome.
That's a technical term that historians use. Fucking idiots. look, and the thing is, even in the Middle Ages, there were people who believed that the earth was flat. They were mainly ignorant peasants. So I was recently rereading a book by a guy called Carlo Ginzburg on some witch trials in Italy in the 16th century. And this one of the guys who gave evidence in this trial gave his cosmology. He basically told the inquisitors what his view of the world was, and he thought the earth was flat. So it's not like there weren't people who believed that the earth was flat, but everyone who was learned, everyone who was educated, knew that the earth was round. Plato's Timaeus, which was one of the works of Plato that they had throughout the whole of the Middle Ages, made the arguments that the earth was round, and everyone read that and go, okay, well, Plato says so, that makes sense. The arguments that you get people using, like Neil deGrasse Tyson using today when talking to those, the fucking idiots that we were just mentioning, are arguments that are straight out of some of the medieval textbooks on cosmology. One of the standard books in medieval universities on cosmology was a book by a guy called John Sacrobosco, and the book was called De Sphaera Mundi, which means the sphere of the world. There's a hint there in that title. And, he used all of the classic he used all the classic arguments for why we know that the earth's round. So, and it's not just that people who were learned knew this stuff. It seems that it was actually quite common knowledge. So we have folk tales which talk about the earth being round. We have one, a book by a guy called Sir John Mandeville, where he talks about a guy who travelled so far into the east that he ended up coming back to his hometown from the west, which is obviously referring to circumnavigation of the planet. And he doesn't then explain to his audience how that works. He just assumed that his audience understood how that would work. This guy walked basically around a spherical world. And then we look at some of the sayings. People talk about the earth being round like an apple. They talk about the earth being round like a ball. And we get this in popular literature in the Middle Ages. And also some of the symbols. So one of the symbols of royal authority was the orb. So, a king would sit on his throne with his scepter, wearing his crown, and in his other hand he would hold the orb, and the orb was a symbol of earthly power, and it was a symbol of the earth. Well, obviously, if people didn't understand that the earth was round, that symbol wouldn't make any sense. You'd be sitting there holding a frisbee or something. So it was very common knowledge. Right? It was very common knowledge that the earth was round. There were still people who stuck to the idea that it was flat, just very few of them. So the idea that the stupid, ignorant medieval church told everyone that the earth was round, that was flat, is a myth. But unfortunately, it gets propagated by people who should know better. So Neil deGrasse Tyson, for example, while debating on Twitter, one of those flat earthers referred to, he said, your thinking is regressed by 500 years. And when people said, oh, no, we've actually known that the earth is around for longer than that, he said, yes, but it was lost during the Dark Ages. And he's wrong. But he's a scientist, and everyone listens to what Neil deGrasse Tyson says, and he's got 54 million Twitter followers. So, unfortunately, this crap gets propagated, which is one of the reasons why, you know, why nerds like me end up writing long articles.
And sorry for we have a little bit of a delay, so it's not us trying to step over you. We'll just have to bear that. But to be honest with you, Tim, what you say, it all sounds great. It all sounds like it fits. But I have to tell you, in this case, I have to side with the man who did the autobiography on the nonfiction of the guy without a head who rode a horse into Sleepy Hollow. That just sounds like it's yeah. more believable than.
Yeah, they had like six what remakes of that. It has to be true.
Yeah, that's right. He was clearly a very learned and rational guy. Yeah.
But let me ask you, Tim, because I mean, I agree with everything you said so far. But is it really a stretch for people to at least rationalize this thing? Because look at. There are people nowadays that put forth this. There are people for the last 200 years put forth the narrative that the earth is 7,000 years old. And my personal belief is it's not a far cry of stupidity to go from 7,000 years old earth to a flat earth. It's just a minor little, let's just go off the edge a little bit more. That's it. So, yeah. I mean, it makes a point. There were churches that the young earth, that there are some now that have gone flat earth in that regard.
So I agree with you, and I understand why people can believe this stuff. What I would say, though, is that level of scientific stupidity that we see in the Protestant, evangelical, fundamentalist Protestant Christianity that has come out of the United States is, again, quite new. It's quite recent. And it's a reaction against the rise of science in the particularly in the late 18th and early 19th century. Christianity in the past has had probably a much more friendly relationship with science. And so the other myth, I suppose, getting back to your question, Kyle, the other myth that I suppose kind of grinds my gears a bit is the way in which many atheists accept what historians refer to as the conflict thesis. And the conflict thesis is an idea in the history of science that religion has always been in conflict with science, and that science has always been trying to move forward and religion has always been trying to drag it back. And the conflict thesis is also known as the Draper-White thesis, which is named after two American writers from the late 19th century who promulgated this theory in a couple of books. It's been rejected by historians of science as being too simplistic. There certainly have been episodes of conflict between religion and science, but it hasn't been a centuries-long warfare between religion and theology, which is between religion and science, which is what the conflict thesis has claimed. But despite the fact that historians have rejected the conflict thesis, it's almost like dogma for many atheists and people like Sam Harris, people like Richard Dawkins. People like Christopher Hitchens basically assumed it as a given, whereas historians of science just drives them nuts because it simply isn't true. There have been periods and certainly have been episodes of conflict between religion and science, but there have also been periods and long periods where religion and science were actually walking hand in hand. And that's why a hell of a lot of some of the major figures of the scientific revolution were deeply religious, people like Kepler, people like Newton. And people sometimes say to me, oh, just because they were religious, that doesn't mean anything, that everyone was religious back then. That's not true. These guys were deeply motivated by their belief in a creator. Now, we can disagree with them on that, but that doesn't take away the impressive feats that they came up with the advances that they made in science. But just because Newton believed deeply in the second coming of Jesus and spent years trying to calculate when it was going to happen. Doesn't mean that the scientific stuff he came up with is somehow invalid. But he was motivated by his religious beliefs. And anyone who tries to deny that, simply all I say is go and read the stuff the guy's writing. Same with Kepler. Not so much with Galileo. Galileo wasn't deeply religious. He was religious. He was a Catholic. But, you know, he was a very Italian Catholic. He had a mistress. He liked getting drunk. You know, he didn't go to mass very often. He was very Italian.
The cool kind of Catholic.
Yeah, that's
back
right.
Then, where was the education? Most of the educational facilities in the universities were mostly theological in nature, were they? Not. I mean, science was, you know, part of natural philosophy back then. It was all big one big thing. And I totally believe that they did treat it as such. The scientists back then were also theologians. They did have very staunch beliefs about deity. Did they not?
We have to back up. We have to be very careful because I get a lot of people saying, well, the universities were basically religious institutions. Actually, they weren't. They were about as religious as any institution was in the Middle Ages, but they began very much as secular institutions. So the universities started to come together in around about the 12th century, and they were effectively kind of like trade unions for scholars and for teachers. And effectively, what happened was that there were teachers who were starting to set up schools, mainly to educate people for the mechanics of government, which was really sort of taking off and becoming much more sophisticated and required more literate people. And so there was a market for smart guys who could read and write. And so, therefore, you know, the teachers got together and said, well, let's form a bit of a trade union. And they called it a universitas, which is where we get the word university. So what happened was you had to go through a series of degrees. We still have degrees in universities. And what you had to do is you had to study the seven liberal arts. And this was why we have what's called an arts degree. You had to get your arts degree, though, before you could then go on to a higher degree and go on and do maybe medicine, law, or theology. So no, they weren't all theologians. They didn't get to do theology until later, and some of them went on to do theology, some of them went on to do law, some of them went on to do medicine, and others just left with their arts degree and went and got a job with the king. So the universities were actually pretty practical products of market demand. But was there a hell of a lot of theology being discussed in the arts faculty? Absolutely. But one of the interesting things is that there was a lot of conflict between the arts faculty and the theology faculty, and every now and then the theology faculty would try and pull rank. And so we had a situation in the 13th century Paris where the theology faculty said, these new books that you guys are reading on Aristotle is saying some stuff that we don't like, so you can't read them anymore, to which the arts faculty said, go fuck yourselves. And then they tried again a few years later and said, all right, well, you can read some of them, but you can't read these bits. And the arts faculty said, no, go fuck yourselves. And then they came back a few decades later and said, here's a list of the stuff in Aristotle that you aren't allowed to believe. And the arts faculty said, yeah, whatever. Whereas the university down the road was putting up, you know, it was advertising itself saying, come to our university and read the books of Aristotle that those dickheads up in Paris aren't allowed to read.
Brilliant. Awesome. Brilliant.
What was going on in these universities was actually quite interesting. They had what they called quadlibets, which were basically no holds barred multi-day debates that anyone could come to, where anyone could step up. It was like sort of mixed martial art cage fighting, except with logic. Anyone could step up and argue anything, right? That God doesn't exist, that God could create a rock so heavy you couldn't lift it, whatever. The whole idea was to show how smart you were by taking on the doctors, so taking on the masters of the various faculties and beating them in debate. And this is how a young scholar could make their mark. Now, when you think about what most people think about when they think of medieval universities, I think people will be sitting there reading the Bible and being, you know, being having dogma thrashed into them. It wasn't like that at all. And this is why I say it's much more interesting to read what was really going on than to rely on lazy cliches. because when you think about that stuff, that's much more interesting than the idea of that most people have in medieval universities of being centers of superstitious obscurantism.
Do you think today that religion is to the point where it's stopping science from progressing any? Like when you think about things like, you know, stem cell research, those kind of things. Yeah. Do you think we're now at that point? Like, would that be true to say now?
I think you are in your country.
Good point.
I think your country is in all sorts of trouble. Right? And back in the 1980s and early 90s, I spent a lot of time on debating creationists, and because I was worried about it spreading from your country to ours. Now, luckily, it hasn't got a major foothold here, but it's gotten worse over in your country. I hate to say it. I love America, but I'm glad I don't live in your country.
Can we export Ken Ham back to you, please? That's the real reason that I wanted to.
Yeah. Sorry about him. What a fuckwit.
Yeah.
I went and saw him talk. It would have been about 1988, I think. And I went armed with my best anti-creationist arguments. And this was back when I was a bit more of an angry young atheist than I am now. And I was just astonished at the way in which he was able to come out with answers to my questions and my objections. They were stupid, but he had them at his fingertips, you know. And this is one of the things I love about crackpots. They always have an answer. It's shit, but they always have an answer. That's right. Yeah, it's usually a waste of time, which is why I kind of gave up. It was, it's a bit like beating your head against the wall.
Yeah. It's good to see that his tactics haven't changed, because he's still using that same method. It hasn't changed one bit since 1980. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So
people buy into that stuff, right? So yeah, it works.
Shouldn't get bogged down in creationism. We'll be here all day.
Oh, that's true. I think we will be anyway. But wait till you get you're not in trouble until you get a Australian version of Kent Hovind. When that happens, we'll send in like the National Guard for you. But right now, you're okay. So let's switch gears a little bit and go to a much more heated subject, and one that actually ties in well with us, because we had one of the biggest proponents of this argument on the show this week on Wednesday, and that is Jesus exist. That's something that's is kind of increasing in its frequency of, you know, popping up everywhere. We've had probably four, I think, haven't we, Steve, debates on the subject, and these are things that they actively, like, these people approached us about doing this subject. It's not one that Steve or I are particularly interested in, because it doesn't bother me if he existed or not, and it doesn't bother Steve if he exists or not either. Like, it doesn't affect the way we look at things, but nonetheless sure. it's topical. So what's your take?
I have studied the origins of Christianity for many, many years, and the reason I'm an atheist is, I was brought up in a Christian family. I wasn't a particularly fanatical Christian, but in my late teens, I sat on the sidelines of a bit of a debate at my high school, conversation between an evangelical Christian and an agnostic. And she kept saying, Jesus said this and Jesus did that, and he kept saying, how do you know? And even though at that stage I was probably more inclined towards her ideas than his, I thought he was making a really good point. And I decided as a young guy who was already very interested in ancient history to go and answer that question. And I went to look at the beginnings of Christianity very confident that I'd be able to answer his question and say, well, here's how we know. 2 years later, I was an atheist, because what I found was that it's pretty clear that Jesus wasn't Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and the second person of the Trinity who walked on water and rose from the dead. He was a Jewish preacher, and that became that was very, very clear. then years later, I kept reading on the origins of Christianity and what we call historical Jesus studies. And when I was at university, I was able to get access to some quite good scholarly literature on that. And I've been building my collection of that kind of stuff for decades since. A few years ago, I started to notice the Jesus mythos was popping up online. And they first appeared on groups on Usenet back in the early 90s on groups like Alt Conspiracy. And so they were really kind of in there amongst the Bigfoot and UFO guys. Suddenly I started to see them on atheist groups in fairly small numbers. And then by about the beginning of the 2000s, they were everywhere. And it's another example of a fringe idea which has been given an enormous boost by online technology, for better or for ill. So what's my take? I conclude that it is most likely that there was a historical Jesus. I conclude that there was a historical preacher called Yeshua, and he's the point of origin for the later stories about the figure called Jesus Christ. Don't believe that he was God. Obviously, don't believe the miracle stories. So why do I disagree with the mythicists? I certainly don't dismiss the possibility that those stories arose in another way. And I think it people who say it's ridiculous that they even say that, I think that's wrong. I think it's a valid idea. I just don't think they're correct. I think on the whole, the arguments of the vast majority of scholars who accept, non-Christian scholars, I should stress, who accept that there was a historical Jesus, simply make more sense. Because what a historian does, historians can't prove anything, right? What a historian does is they make an argument to the best explanation. So they look at all the evidence that's relevant to the question. They look at the various ways in which that evidence can be explained. And then they try to come up with what is the most likely way that evidence can be explained. And so the argument to the best explanation is the one that counts for the most evidence, with the least number of suppositions, ad hoc workarounds and what-ifs. And my problem with mythicism is that it's riddled with suppositions, ad hoc workarounds and what-ifs, because it seems to be fairly clearly, even though they wouldn't see it this way, a case of someone starting with their conclusion, there was no Jesus, and then trying to find evidence and find ways to line up the evidence to lead to that conclusion. And that's not the way you do history.
Were you?
Sorry, that was long.
No, that was good. I was just going to say, are you a? Do you think that the accounts that were put forth by Steve and I's favorite two people on the planet, Josephus and Tacitus, are accurate?
Ooh,
I'm going to hear them. There's
a big topic. Well, first of all, let's start with Tacitus. Tacitus is a great source for ancient historians, because he's actually for an ancient historian, he's actually pretty skeptical. He's very good at checking his facts. He didn't accept mere hearsay. He didn't like reporting rumor, and when he did, he said, you know, it is rumored that, or he was often said that. So he was actually a pretty careful historian. And he says about Jesus, he says, this guy, Christus, which is the Latin form of the Greek word Christos, which is the Greek form of the word Messiah. So this guy, the Messiah, the so-called Messiah, was executed by Pontius Pilate in Judea during the reign of Tiberius. So he tells us who he was, a troublemaker, because he was executed, where in Judea, by who, Pilate, and when. This is pretty bold, and there's nothing in there that indicates that he was getting this information from Christians. Now, the way that most mythicists dismiss this is by saying, oh, he's just reporting what Christians said. Well, there's nothing actually that says that. Now, we don't know where he got his information, but there's nothing in what he says that indicates that it was from Christians. He also thought Christians were stupid, superstitious peasants, and it's very unlikely that an aristocratic senator like Tacitus would have been hanging around with Christians anyway. So where would he have been talking to Christians about Jesus? Where did he get his information? Well, as I said, we don't know. But there were several people at the court of the Emperor Titus who moved in the same circles as Tacitus, who would have been the obvious source of information about a Jewish sect because they were aristocratic Jews living in exile in Rome after the Jewish revolt of 66 or 70 AD. Several of these were people that we know Tacitus probably would have moved amongst and met. One of them was the Princess Berenice, who was the daughter of Herod Agrippa, so a pretty obvious person to go to ask about a Jewish sect. Another was Josephus, who was living in Rome at the time and was a working historian. Now, we don't know if Tacitus actually met Josephus, but if you line up what Josephus says about Jesus in the much-disputed Testimonium Flavianum, strip out the stuff that everyone agrees are Christian interpolations, there's actually quite an overlap between what Tacitus says and what Josephus says. So is he right? Well, it certainly looks that way. We can't say this is a slam dunk, though, because obviously it's not direct testimony, and also because we don't know where he got his information from. But it's from a very reliable, highly skeptical source. So I think it's a vector of evidence that points in the direction of Jesus being historical. So what about Tacitus? What about Josephus? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the issue with Josephus is that obviously we've got two references to Jesus, one of which has clearly been tampered with by Christians. So it has Josephus saying stuff that we know Josephus would not have said, such as he was the Messiah, such as his followers saw him again on the third day. There's a couple of other elements in there which may or may not be Christian additions, but we know that those two pieces in particular clearly are, and everyone agrees on that. So the debate then is how much of the so-called testimonium passage is genuine, or is it all an interpolation? Now, a good case can be made for it being all an interpolation, and I respect the scholars, many of whom are not mythicists, but I respect the scholars who make that case, and I think that it's something that can be argued very credibly. I don't agree. I happen to agree with the majority of scholars who think that it was partially authentic, and I think that's a better case can be made for that. But on the whole, I don't put a lot of weight on the testimonium, precisely because we can't say, as we can say with Tacitus, that it's an unadulterated source. But then there's the second reference to Jesus, which is in Book 20 of the Antiquities of the Jews. This one's interesting because he mentions Jesus very much in passing while talking about something else. So this is a reference to Jesus and his brother James in Book 20, 200 of Antiquities. And what Josephus is writing about here is a political event that was quite a significant political event, the deposition, so the deposing of the high priest, Hanan ben Hanan, who he calls Ananus. This is significant because Josephus was about 25 or 26 at the time when this happened. Josephus was a member of a priestly family himself and lived in Jerusalem, grew up in Jerusalem, and was either in Jerusalem at the time or had just came back very soon afterwards because he'd just been on a diplomatic embassy to Rome. So he tells the story of how Hanan illegally executed some people and then got deposed as a result. And he mentions in passing that one of these people was the brother of that Jesus who was called Messiah, named James. So what we've got here is first-hand testimony from someone who was in the city at the time, who was closely connected to the events that he was relating, saying almost in passing, one of the guys who was executed was this guy James, and identifying him by reference to his more famous brother. This one is very, very difficult for mythicists to make go away. And there are arguments that try to, Richard Carrier, for example, has written an article trying to argue that the words "who was called Messiah" have been interpolated into this passage. No other scholar I know of accepts that. And there are major problems with Carrier's argument, which are quite technical and linguistic, so I won't go into.
Bayesian approach?
No historian I know of uses that other than Richard Carrier.
Well, that is something he kind of does uniquely, is it not? I mean, he does, even with his Bayesian analysis, he only comes up with a two-thirds chance that Jesus didn't exist, right?
But the problem with the idea of trying to use Bayes' theorem with history is that with history, we don't actually have any data objective data to plug into the theorem. So if I want to try and work out whether it's going to rain next weekend because I want to hold a picnic, I can plug objective data about rainfall in the Sydney area if it goes back 200 years into Bayes' theorem, and a probability will come out the other end that's based on real-world objective data. The problem with what Carrier does is he makes an assessment of the likelihood of the various elements that he's putting into the theorem. He then gives them a number, and then he plugs them into Bayes' theorem, and another number comes out the other end. Well, you know, garbage in, garbage out. It's basically smoke and mirrors. So I don't know why people get so excited about it. I think it's effectively, you know, it makes his conclusions look more hard and fast than they actually are. It's pointless.
Yeah, because I always thought you
could always pray for good weather for your picnic, though.
No worries. Of course I would. The problem is which god, but yeah, of course.
One of them will send rain. It doesn't matter. Just pick one. Maybe one will give you rain. But I always thought with Bayesian that you always had to have past prior events, which you could draw from, which had to be actual data that you can actually use.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that not the case?
And so, yeah, absolutely. So, and this is why historians don't use it.
Do you think that the Jesus that's described in the Bible, aside from the things that we know can't be true, like being crucified, raised from the dead, raising other people from the dead, do you think that Jesus that's talked about is the Jesus that existed, or do you just think he was a preacher and they kind of embellished some of these stories?
Yeah, a combination of the two. So, an argument that some people have made to me is that people have said to me, if you're talking about a Jesus who is non-miraculous and isn't divine and didn't rise from the dead, if you take all the miracles out of the Bible stories, there's nothing left. And that's not true. And actually, to prove to one of these guys that that's not true, I actually sat down with this is the stuff I do for fun, guys. I actually sat down with a copy of the Gospel of Mark and went through it chapter by chapter and wrote a summary of each chapter and took out the miracles. And it was interesting, two things that struck me at the end of that. First of all, it's not true that there's nothing left. There's actually a quite coherent story there. And it was also interesting how little I had to take out, because a hell of a lot of the Gospels, particularly the Synoptic Gospels, and particularly Mark, which is the earliest of the Gospels, it simply says Jesus went to this place and said this, or Jesus went here and told this story, or some people came to Jesus and asked him a question and this is what Jesus said. So when you take out the miracles, there's still all that stuff. And effectively what you've got there is a reasonably coherent story about a Jewish apocalyptic preacher who went around teaching that the end of the world was coming and then annoyed the authorities enough to get himself crucified. Now, is that exactly what happened? Something like it, I think. But when you look at the stuff in the Bible that isn't, well, you look at the stuff in the Gospels, if you got some stuff that clearly isn't true. So walking on water and feeding 5,000 obviously did not happen. You got some other stuff that falls into that category because we can compare it to other sources of information about the period, and we can say it's pretty unlikely that that happened. So things like Pontius Pilate deciding on the eve of Passover each year to release some zealot or freedom fighter. Well, that doesn't make any fucking sense, and it also doesn't fit with anything we know about Pontius Pilate, who was like an A-grade arsehole. So that almost certainly didn't happen. Then you got a huge chunk of stuff that could have happened. So could Jesus have gone to Capernaum and told a parable about something? Yeah, sure. Can we ever make a determination as to whether or not it did? No, not at all. But we're still left with a core of stuff which not only could have happened but actually looks kind of likely. And one of those things, for example, is the idea that Jesus taught that the end of the world was coming, if not in his lifetime, then in the lifetime of the people listening to it, because that turned out to not be true. And we also see, as you look at the progression of the Gospels from Mark to Matthew and Luke and then to John, you see that part very prominent in the early Gospel, in the earliest Gospel, Mark, but it gets downplayed increasingly and then disappears almost completely by the time you get to John. So what seems to be happening is that as the story of Jesus is being told, the bits that are kind of inconvenient but were in the early versions because they actually happened get downplayed or get changed. So the prediction that the end of the world was coming is in the earliest Gospels because Jesus, most likely because Jesus made that prediction. So I think there are some things we can say are true. I think it's very, very likely that he was baptized by John the Baptist because that formed a fairly awkward element in the Gospels that they all had to kind of play with in order to make it fit with their ideas about Jesus. And I think it's almost certain that he had a brother called James, because not only is he mentioned by Josephus in the passage that I just mentioned, but there's also a reference to him in Paul's letter to the Galatians, where he's saying, I didn't meet any of those guys in Jerusalem. I didn't get my teaching from them. I'm not subordinate to them. I didn't meet any of them, except Peter and James, the brother of the Lord. So it's a bit difficult to say that Jesus didn't have a brother called James, but we got Paul saying that he met him. And that passage, that particular text, Galatians 1:19, is another major problem for Jesus' witnesses. And again, they've got very elaborate arguments to get around it, but they're all pretty contrived. The most logical, the most parsimonious way when you apply Occam's razor to read that passage is that Paul met Jesus' brother, which meant Jesus existed.
All right. Steve, did you have... It does.
Just one thing. I mean, do we all kind of agree that it's not a hill to die on for atheists? I mean, if Jesus lived or not is not something that everybody should go around like, oh, it's going to make a big, somebody's belief. If obviously, I think clearly, if Jesus didn't exist, then obviously Christianity has to be
false. Which Jesus, though? Well, the one that rose from the dead or the one that just died?
Well, even because
it's a hill to die on if he rose from the dead.
Well, that's true. If a man didn't exist, then he couldn't have rose from the dead, right? One entails the other. So if there's no such being that named Jesus that ever was part of the Christian narrative, then everything that comes subsequently after that is wrong. But I think most people are happy to say, yeah, there probably was some kernel of truth. There probably was some being named or dude named Jesus or Christo or whatever. I mean, whatever term that they used for him. I thought it was originally supposed to be Joshua, was it? What was his original name?
That was Yeshua. Yeshua.
I'm happy. I've never been a mythicist, although I like Richard a lot. I think Richard Currier is really a great guy. I don't subscribe to his methodology. It's an interesting theory. Don't get me wrong. I mean, he's every right to try to promote it. But I don't think it's something that atheists should go around going, oh, there was no Jesus. Because I think that's a really high burden to bear on that.
It doesn't change anything whether he did or he didn't, in my opinion. So, I mean, why argue about it?
Yeah, I think the reason that people latch onto it is that, and Dave just made this point, that if he didn't exist at all, then there's no way that Christianity could be in any way true, because Christianity depends on historical claims. And so if you can undercut those historical claims completely by saying there was no Jesus, then you basically there's no there. There's nothing that Christianity can rest on. So from a rhetorical point of view, mythicism works extremely well, and this is one of the reasons why a lot of people do embrace it. The other thing that I have noticed, though, is that there's a very large overlap between people who are committed and passionate, and believe me, they can get bloody passionate, mythicists, and people who used to be fundamentalist Christians. Now, I'm not saying that all mythicists used to be fundamentalist Christians. I mean, Richard Carrier didn't used to be a fundamentalist Christian. But what I'm saying is that I've come across a hell of a lot of former fundamentalists who have really drunk the Kool-Aid on mythicism. And I suppose the interesting thing from my point of view is that a lot of them are very emotionally attached to the idea that Jesus didn't exist. And it seems that these people seem to be people who think in absolutes. They can only think in black and white. So it's either all true or it's not true at all. And I've heard fundamentalist preachers say that. They say you can't accept bits of the Gospels. Either it's all literally true, it all happened, or it didn't happen at all. And this is very much a fundamentalist line of thinking. And therefore, there's a hell of a lot of people who seem to have taken that across once they've lost their faith to embrace the opposite extreme. The other thing that I have noticed is that if you Google something about the historical Jesus, and you're trying to find some information online about how Christianity could have arisen without all the magic, what tends to come up is mythos stuff. So a hell of a lot of people who are having doubts about their Christianity and having doubts about their maybe their faith in God, they go looking for information about how did Christianity arise if there was no God. And the first thing they tend to find is mythos stuff, because the stuff that I read is mainly academic. It's pretty scholarly. A lot of it's pretty dense. Some of it isn't exactly the most fascinating reading. And there's a real gap for people who are leaving Christianity, where there's nothing for them to actually latch onto apart from mythicism. And this is one of the reasons why mythicism is making such an impact within the atheist movement, despite the fact that most scholars think it's fucking bullshit.
That kind of thinking carries over too, because we have people that like, for example, with you know, especially with the flat earthers, but other people that we've had on here, like the guy, the Skype Peter that we had, they will find something where the government or NASA or somebody has lied about one thing, and they can prove that they lied about that one thing, and therefore everything that comes after that is a lie. Like, even so far as going to the extreme that gravity is a lie made up for, I mean, these, it's scary to think that you can't distinguish between something that actually may be a lie, something that may have happened, something that a government could have covered up, because we all know that the government has probably covered up a lot of things, but that doesn't mean that everything from that point on that the government does is a lie or a cover up. And that's how you get these people who now believe in, or they call science, scientism. They're anti science. So therefore anything to do with religion is inherently evil, and the devil does it. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. So and it gets back to, no, I'm fine, mate. And again, that's your Skype healing. Yeah.
I'm doing it.
Thanks, man.
Because if you don't have a headache, it works. You're welcome.
I fell into one of your topics that you cover. And like I said, guys, we could probably dive into the Jesus thing a lot deeper, and we will, but I kind of want to hit a couple of these. But one that I kind of subscribe to, not anymore, but that at the beginning I did, was the idea that the church and Nazis were at some point linked.
Yeah.
And so let's go into that one a little bit.
Yeah. Okay, so this is the whole story of Hitler's Pope, and the idea that Pope Pius XII in particular was a good buddy of Adolf Hitler, and that the church backed the Nazis, and that they didn't condemn the Holocaust, and it's a great story, and I mean, who doesn't like to hate the Catholic Church? It's great fun. They're such assholes. But again, just because many of the things that we can say about the Catholic Church that are bad are true, such as covering up child sexual abuse for years, doesn't mean everything that then gets said about the Catholic Church that's bad is true. So, no, Pius XII was not pro-Nazi. He was vehemently anti-Nazi, and he was one of the earliest voices speaking out against the Nazis, because in the 1920s, he was the papal nuncio to first to Munich and then to Berlin. So he actually identified very early on that the Nazis were an extremely dangerous group, even when they were actually quite small. And at a couple of points when he was back in Rome, before he became Pope, there was one point where someone said to him, oh, but because, you know, the communists are much more of a problem. And he turned to this guy and said, the Nazis are far worse. Right, so he was vehemently anti-Nazi. So where did the idea that the papacy was somehow friends of the Nazis come from? If you said went back to, say, 1952 and said to anyone that the papacy had been pro-Nazi during the war, they'd think you were nuts. This idea didn't start to arise until the 1960s, and it really became it was very much a left-wing idea. Some of it seems to have been actively fed to the West by the Soviet Union as a kind of a psyops, a program to discredit the papacy, because there were lots of Catholics in Poland in particular and Czechoslovakia, and so discrediting the papacy was actually a very useful thing for the Soviets. Some of it was simply just counterculture You know, the Catholic Church is evil, so, you know, let's just say they were pro-Nazis. But when you look at the evidence, it's absolutely clear that they weren't. And I think if there's one book that I would recommend anyone read, it's a book by a guy called Mark Riebling, came out, I think it was last year or the year before, called Church of Spies, The Papacy's Secret War Against the Nazis. And that's a book that, that actually could change Sam Harris's mind on this, because Sam Harris absolutely accepted the myth of Hitler's Pope. And then he read Mark Riebling's book and he interviewed him on his podcast and said to Mark Riebling, "You completely changed my mind on this." Because what Riebling shows is that the papacy, for some complicated historical reasons, decided to choose a path of outward diplomatic neutrality towards the Nazis. But underneath, behind the scenes, they were working to overthrow Hitler right from the start and were actively involved in at least two, probably three plots to overthrow Hitler, and were actively involved in two plots to kill him. There was a meeting in you know, someone should make a movie about this. There was a meeting in the crypt of St. Peter's where they met with members of the German resistance, and where one of the secretaries to the Pope basically said, "The Pope gives you the thumbs up to kill Hitler. You know, we've checked the theology. There is a precedent for if someone is truly evil and is an absolute tyrant, there is a precedent in the theology to say, yep, you can kill it. And so go ahead, literally with our blessing, kill the cunt." Now, I challenge anyone to read that book and say he was pro-Nazi, right? It's just bullshit. It's total bullshit. There's a more complicated question about the papacy and the Holocaust, and should the papacy have spoken out more strongly against the Holocaust? And that's a much more controversial question, and certainly a good argument can be made that perhaps they should have. I think when you look at it in context, you can sort of see why perhaps they didn't, but it's easy to be sort of wise in hindsight and say, well, maybe they should have said more.
Yeah.
But that's a slightly different question, because there are a hell of a lot of people who didn't speak out against the Holocaust. There are a hell of a lot of people who didn't act to save Jews. Churchill, for example, decided not to bomb the train tracks to Auschwitz. So there are a lot of people who made some poor decisions. But as far as the Pope being a friend of the Nazis, that's just fucking nonsense. And anyone who says that is just they don't know what they're talking about.
What about I heard in a Hitchens debate one time, he brought up that the two kind of sort of pacts were signed by the first two actual contracts, I guess you would call them, between the Nazi Germany and Mussolini's fascist regime were with the Catholic Church. What's the story behind that?
Well, he's wrong. There were several pacts signed with the Nazi regime in 1933 before the what's called the Concordat. So Hitchens is just factually wrong there. There was a trade pact with Britain. In fact, even before the Concordat was signed and ratified, there was a pact with a Jewish organization based in Palestine that made an agreement with the Nazi regime. So one is factually wrong. Two, what Hitchens does in that passage is he talks about, in God Is Not Great, is he talks about this as though the Concordat was some kind of chummy agreement that the church signed to because they were such good friends with Hitler. Actually, a Concordat is an agreement that the Vatican signs usually with a regime that is unfriendly to try and mitigate the unfriendliness. So to try and say, okay, well, we don't like each other, but here are the rules of engagement. Here is what, you know, we will do. We won't hinder you in these ways, but you've got to leave our schools open, not attack our priests, not put our priests in concentration camps and so on. The Concordat that was drawn up wasn't actually drawn up with the Nazis. It was drawn up with the Weimar Republic, the regime before the Nazis came to power, and hadn't actually been signed. So what the Nazis did was they brought that to the Vatican and said, "You must sign this because this is the only offer we're going to give you, right? This is the best offer you're going to get." And then the Pope was really in a bit of a dilemma. Do I sign this, even though I know that it's not good, and I don't trust these guys, and I know they're probably going to break their word, or do I not sign it, and they will then have free reign to do whatever the hell they want against the church in Germany? And in the weeks leading up to him making a decision, they rounded up priests, they threw them in concentration camps, they shut down Catholic newspapers, they smashed presses, and so on. So they really put on the pressure. And a British diplomat at the time reported back to London and said, after they'd signed the Concordat, and said the Pope had a gun to his head. He didn't have anywhere to go. Now, in retrospect, should he have made an agreement with Adolf Hitler? In retrospect, no. But then again, in the 1930s, there were a lot of people making agreements with Adolf Hitler who later came to regret them. Neville Chamberlain made an agreement with Adolf Hitler thinking that it was going to avoid the Second World War, and Hitler broke it. Joseph Stalin made an agreement with Adolf Hitler, and that didn't exactly work out terribly well either. So lots of people were trusting Adolf Hitler who shouldn't have, in retrospect. But at the time, when you look at it in context, it kind of made sense. But I think the main point to remember is that the Concordat was not some chummy agreement. It was trying to limit the damage, because they hated the Nazis, and the Nazis knew it. This is the other thing about this idea that they were friends of the Nazis. If they were friends of the Nazis, then the Nazis didn't get the memo, because the Nazis referred to the papacy as called the Pope, the ally of the Jewish war criminals. They banned listening to Vatican radio. You could get called off by the Gestapo for listening to Vatican radio. So it's a bit odd if they were meant to be such chums that they were so unfriendly. I said, you know, Hitchens is a great polemicist, but he sometimes didn't let little things like facts get in the way of his rhetoric. I love Hitchens stuff, and I always found him highly amusing. But on history in particular, he's actually pretty unreliable.
And go back to a point that you were talking about just a second ago, where people fall for, you know, Hitler or trusting when they shouldn't have. I was watching something that went back and showed the pictures from I forget what year, but the year that Berlin had the Olympics, and you see everyone, you know, all the different countries there. Hitler comes out, waves. I mean, and it's just like thinking about what he would be in, you know, a few years' time. It's just kind of eerie to see.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of the problems when you're studying history. You have to try and look at it from the perspective of what was happening at the time. And it's always a bit of a trap to think that the people then should have known what we know, because there's no way they could have.
Yeah, do we not tend to look at history from our